discuss it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm not supposed to talk, so that's it. Bye-bye. But I actually kind of very thankful for organizers, and it's a fantastic workshop, and both conference was great, and I so much enjoyed here interaction with people. And thank you for this kind of second opportunity to talk. And I tried to make it very informal. There will be some story about the previous work that's been done in my lab as a background. I will briefly repeat what we've been, very shortly, briefly repeat what I talked about on the main talk, just to put everything in perspective. But I would present a new story. It's nothing yet published, and want your feedback, basic interpretation, and how we proceed further, because I wanted rather more discussion than, you know, final Polish talk. We are interested in how these patterns are read by brain and actually work behavior. And I probably don't need to describe it in this audience. This is the when odor is presented, it evokes activity of a bunch of glomeruli, and different odor evoke different patterns, and the same odor evoke also different patterns. But what you can see that number of glomeruli, active glomeruli increases as you increase the concentration. So brain somehow need to make sense out of these patterns, put this into the same category, into different categories, put this into the same category. However, the another task of the brain is to discriminate the concentration, but if you ask what the order, it should be the same order. So all this constraint, all this, you know, behavioral needs and behavioral constraints, put the constraints on the code. And what we would like to try to understand how this is basically read by the next level cell and sent to the cortex. I would briefly
Are these, I can't remember, are these mitral cell activity or
no, this is ORN. This is actually interesting enough. This is the first paper of use of genetically encoded activity indicators in mammals. So both knock in synaptofluorin into OSNs, ORN, and image activity of the glomeruli.
What about genetically encoded chloride sensors? Chlamydia?
I would love to have this reference, please.
This is Augustine and
But they did make some work on, okay. Sorry. That's
us.
And just for the reference, whatever I said here already been done by Andreas. So let's briefly reformulate the problem that if you increase concentration, you increase the total number of glomeruli. Interestingly enough, it seems to me that intensity is not it varies as you increase concentration, but you can't make much sense in many cases because, for example, this glomeruli at a higher concentration is more intense than another glomeruli that appears at a lower concentration. However, that kind of knowledge came from the calcium imaging, and calcium and the indicator expression may be different, so I don't know. I don't want to make much sense out of intensity. So how...
Do you need available data, how prevalent is this?
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I don't know. I don't know because the expression of the calcium indicators is different, so how you judge the intensity of the glomerular activation and other stuff, you know. So far we'll currently forget about intensity.
The intensity of the calcium indicator is different between glomerular.
Yes, expression of calcium indicator is different between glomerular. So we cannot say for sure. And how you actually measure the intensity of one glomerular, even if calcium indicator will be the same, because what you're actually interested in the transmission to the next level cells, there's a lot of variability. I don't know. So the common in these three patterns is these two glomeruli, but not if you don't mark them, you don't know how to put these patterns together. So what we propose in our model is that a glomeruli actually activated in time, And as you increase concentration first, you activate the first two glomeruli, H and F. The same two glomeruli got activated at the next concentration, and even at the highest concentration, the first two glomeruli are the same, H, F, A, G, L, K, but the first two remain the same. So if somehow you know the first two glomeruli, you know the order. And the model that we call, and it's either the first, we call it primacy coding, and it's either the first P glomeruli or the first temporal window. What's important here is that it's enough to identify the order by the small number of glomeruli P. And second, these glomeruli are kind of irrelevant for order identification. Don't know for what they're relevant, but for order identification, they're irrelevant. And as I set it up, this model is, you know, I obey concentration invariance. So we can identify order independently or concentration. There are multiple questions related to this model. What are the neural mechanisms responsible to that? How this code can be read? What are the code features? How can we prove that window of relevant information is actually short and located here, and this is irrelevant? And I will talk about Tufted and mitral cell signature. Yes?
Do you literally mean the first two? Or do you mean the first few?
I mean P. Yeah.
So this is for like the animals who can sniff, I guess, where you always have some onset of saying this is like from now the coding starts or something. You have to have some.
I don't know. This is actually an interesting question, and I talked a little bit about it on the main conference. So I don't know. It's basically the first who comes. So basically, you don't have anything. So maybe it's with a sniff. I know that sniffing has nothing to do with odor perception in humans, because you can do a very long sniff and pop the odor in the middle of the sniff, and you can identify the odor. So sniff per se is not a reference. Right. However, you don't have anything, and you have a bunch of activity, and that may be the first who comes. Is important. Again, in mice cannot do what they cannot do long sniff and pop the odor. Maybe sniff is an important cue. I don't know. But what we're saying, the first in active pattern.
Yeah, right. But the question is, what is first? When if you have like a continuous signal, you could just shift your first, right? And the sequence.
Well, we chunk the so they are function differently from other sensor from audition is we chunk the information. So anyway, you inhale it. It's maybe it's not the kind of onset of the sniff, but you inhale and you get a stream of information. Again, this is oversimplified model. This is, you know.
So I mean, it is true, right, that if you look in the retina, you might think that in order to find the first spike, you need to have an onset for the stimulus. But if you show a natural movie, you'll find that the most, even when you're looking at a group of 50 cells, 60 cells, maybe 100 cells in the neighborhood, the most likely thing is that they're all silent.
I see.
So that means that first can be defined even in the continuous stream.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Because there's a lot of silence.
I don't know
what the situation is here.
But it's not silent all the time.
The problem is
high,
that.
High based on farthest.
Well, the problem is that we just recently discovered that most of the mitral cells are not firing, and I would
reference. Maybe that solves it.
Huh?
Yeah. Maybe that solves it.
Maybe that's what?
Maybe that solves it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but I think it's different, Bill, because in the retina, in the visual system, you can have a group of cells that are clustered where that particular group
yes.
is firing.
Fair
and
enough.
And then there's
yeah.
topographic projection, right? So this is.
Do we know anything about if you observe, if you put a fiber on these guys and you watch the, you do the experiment of watching the calcium indicator, but you do with a fiber and just let it run around in some environment?
It's never been done. It's never been done. But guys, no. Look, some of the glomeruli. So okay, some of the glomeruli are actually activated by very low concentration and locked to the sniffing. So I talked to Matt Vecchio. He see that if he make a very careful measurement, some of the glomeruli just even without order just activated with sniffing. But he said when he cleaned the order even more, the intensity was lower. So you have always this activity, either We don't know it. But let's discuss this later, because that will leave us to the different point.
Just one more question here.
Yeah.
Since you brought up that anyway, how well does the mitral cells map signal?
That's what I'm going to talk whole talk today.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment that there are two ways to generalize this. Like, one of them is to say that it actually, the most responsive glandular are.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah.
Like, for example, the ones which have the highest affinity, they will be the brightest ones, you know. It will make a little bit of a difference for the code. And the more general, I guess, formulation was just to say that it pays attention to a few glandulars, like some selection. There is a sparse subset of glandular, active glandular identified.
So, to reiterate it, basically, to identify the order or small number of glandular chosen, we think that in at least mammals, the way how they chosen is via timing, but it does mean that timing should be always present, so I'm not I will show the case for timing, but maybe in the intensity in other species can work. The strongest glomerular may be the most important, and it's enough to have very few to identify the order. That's the main essence, and that's kind of, actually it was converging theme on many, many talks during the conference, yes.
So because the dorsal receptors are more anteriorly located, would you say the dorsal receptors have more dominant role in this scheme?
Maybe. No, look, there's a lot of caveats to this, and I would say that, you know, it's just oversimplified. We need kind of to start with something and then see maybe dorsal receptors are faster, but there's some other mechanism, but let's pretend that, you know, everything is equal, everything is simple, and move on and I talked on the conference about this aspect, code features, a little bit about neural mechanisms. Today we'll be focusing about neural mechanism and mitotactile cell signature of the primacy code. But I will talk a little bit, just briefly remind you how we define the window of relevant information and how the code can be read. So just to remind you, what did we do? So basically, we assume that the short window of information is important for the order identification. And this window, at now experiment, is not small number of glomeruli, it's rather, you know, short window of information. We try to identify it in experiment. And for that, we take a mouse and train it to identify, to discriminate between two orders, A and B, by leaking left and right. The mouse is sitting in front of order port, head fixed. To eliminate concentration as the Q, we scramble concentrations to order of magnitude. And so basically, mouse needs to make a decision based on order identity. And by order identity, I call it everything but not concentration, because concentration is not a cue. So just to avoid what is order identity, how it's interpreted, it's just something that is orthogonal to concentration. And during this task, we record sniffing. It's schematically shown here, exhalation, inhalation, and that's where the order comes into the nose. So we trigger the odor valve by the exhalation. So when the odor comes already, when mouse starts inhaling, we know the concentration of the odor, and mouse leak left or right, depending on the odor A and B. Now, what we do here, we use mouse that has general adoption of receptors. And we implant two optical fiber in both nostrils, and we actually age the fiber to make them shine as bright as possible. We try to mask odor with a light presentation in a very time-controllable fashion. And what I mean by that, we locked the mask signal to the onset of inhalation and vary the onset of the mask. The idea, if we mask at the very beginning of the sniff cycle, and the very beginning of the sniff cycle is important, mouse wouldn't be able to do the experiment. And as we move back, it starts performing the task. So first of all, nobody told us before that you can mask light by order. Oh, sorry, you can mask order by light, because we didn't expect to excite all the epithelium. We excite some portion of the epithelium. And second, the most important part: what the time when you unmask the signal. And okay. More important thing is that mouse is trained to discriminate order A versus order B, independent on concentration, only on small subset of trials, and two intermediate concentration represents a mask. It's a cage trials. So animal does not learn the mask. And the result is shown here. So
why did you tie the mask to particular concentrations?
No. We tied the mask to the onset of inhalation, but we present the mask on the subset of trials for two concentrations.
I guess if I understood the logic of the experiment, I would have expected that you would just do it on randomly chosen trials with no reference to the concentration.
It's just basically because we have finite number. It's kind of randomly chosen between two trials. We cannot do all five because just a number of... So you need to train the mouse, and the number of probe trials is small. And you vary the parameter T mask, so there's
the performance is concentration dependent.
Yes.
So if you want to measure a change.
Yes. So it just, okay. Okay. Logistics of experiment, and the result is shown here. So without the mask, at the low concentration, mouse perform about 92%, and with the mask, if mask is short, the performance drop to about below 60%. And above 100 millisecond, it's levels down. And this is concentration dependent, because at higher concentration without mask, it performs 95%, and mask actually shifts a little bit left.
Yeah, maybe a nitpicking question, but if you go for even later onset, is it ever really going back to the no mask situation?
Sorry, I have...
Or is it that the light is somewhat irritating a little bit?
You can see it here.
So they're really not bothered by the
not bothered. And at some moment they actually start responding in 150 milliseconds, so it doesn't matter.
So across animals?
It's four animals. Yeah, it's across animals. It's multiple animals.
And each animal has a similar kind of dependence, not that there each animal has its own.
It's slightly variable. That's a good question. We see the effects per animal. What's interesting, we do see its effect even for order A or order B independently. So when we mask, it's not that it always chooses it as a B. There's slightly difference, but it's kind of messed up each individual performance. Yeah. I don't have data now to show it in more details.
Did you try one nostril?
No. Why?
Because there's a difference between mask and destructive.
I call it destructive. I mean,
it may not be an important difference.
I don't think that it's actually important, because the main point here is not the nature of the mask. I would be very happy if we do it with a sound or something. Well, it is important that it goes through the same channel. But the most important thing that it does work here and it doesn't work here. That's a self-control, basically. You don't need to do any other controls. So. It's a strong hammer. We hammer the all receptors. It's definitely, but this hammer works here and doesn't work here. So, yes.
But if this actually you look only at the B first glomeruli, wouldn't you have expected to be a step function, like the?
How often do you see step function biology?
You know, but
in behavior.
Like, at some point, it should be
true. That's what I was asking.
No. It's not a step function. But important part that accumulation of information happening here. Look, I can make a case as soon as you start getting one glomerulus, maybe it's more close to A than to B, than two glomerulus, and so on and so forth. So accumulation of information happening between 60 and 100 milliseconds approximately.
Sorry, is the sketch of the inhalation, is that?
Real.
That's real.
It's so, average, yeah. It's the time scale is actually real.
So he's only inhaling for an order of 100 milliseconds.
Well, but order stays there much, much longer. So, and when I show further the activity of mitral.
Do we actually know that, or is that another one of these everybody knows nobody measured?
About other.
Yeah.
So there was modeling done. So I don't know any method, and if somebody knows, please let me know how to measure real concentration in the mucus with time resolution.
No, a little bit of OSM firing pattern.
No, what we're saying about stimulus. OSM firing pattern we do know, but if I want to measure concentration in the mucus as a function of time, I don't know the methods, and please, I would
you
be very...
You can do concentration in mucus, but you can't do concentration at the receptor, right? So if you...
On the receptor, right.
If you have odor in one side and measure what comes out, you can measure how much is sorbing into mucus, but you don't know where, right? Different parts of mucus might get different amounts. That's hard to get.
Yes. So this is... I know this has been a subject of very intense modeling, with the grid fluid dynamics models and diffusion through the mucus, that shows more or less that concentration goes slowly, and it depends on many physical properties. And we know that receptor responds at different time. Actually, receptor. I have a graph in different and the previous talk. So, if you look at the
that may predict that if you use an order of very different physical chemical property, this timing will be.
Yes. Actually, we'll talk a little bit about it later.
Well, the mitral cells, they respond to all the same cycle.
Yes, the mitral cells respond to.
They start to respond to some of the muscle.
Yeah, but transduction, you don't know the transduction times really, right? So you could transient absorption and then.
Wachowiak measured the onset of inhalation of the glomeruli, and if this is a sniff cycle, and basically many others, many glomeruli, just timing. So if this is order where the glomeruli, where the calcium imaging, this time he measured calcium imaging.
Turn it persistently, you can turn the lights on and
yes.
And then turn it off.
Okay. So basically the distribution goes like this, with the average peak about 150 millisecond peak of the glomeruli, and our effect is somewhere here. So we, if this is true and this is general,
you're driving the receptor neurons or the glomeruli.
I'm driving receptor neurons. So we have 15 millisecond time shift. He also measured the time shift between receptor. So if he stimulate, not with general rhodopsin electrically receptor neurons, he see 10, 15 millisecond shift in the glomeruli. It doesn't make much difference, but we activate basically this part of the distribution. The rest of the distribution is kind of irrelevant for this behavior.
Have you done the other experiment where you, instead of when you turn the mask on, you always have the mask on, but then when is it turned off? So a scenario where the mask starts at time zero and then finishes at time 60, let's say 60
milliseconds. So actually this is I showed two graphs, and this was subject of my previous discussion. I knew that if I start showing it will be a long discussion, but I actually like it very and encourage this. So basically the previous graph was with a long mask that lasts for half a second. Then we decided, okay, what if we do very short mask, 10 millisecond duration, and that was enough to do the behavior. So small perturbation at the beginning of the sniff cycle, even very short, is enough to do perturbation. Basically, that was the we make some effort to estimate the duration of the short mask on the level of the mitral tuft cells. And so the main conclusion from all this experiment, that information is available here. Information is for this is available, but if you perturb at the beginning, mouse doesn't do the right decision.
So Timothy, I don't know if you were able to do this experiment. Our experiment, you collect lots of mitral cells.
Yes.
And you get the population response without the mask and with the mask in different places.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of how? Because you can perturb it here, but you could leave a persistent trace of that right in the.
Should I switch into? I talked about it on the main.
Yeah, just quickly remind me.
So basically, the idea was,
if you're not going to get to that. At all.
I'm not. I wasn't planning because I've been told, giving a second talk, not to talk at all about what I talk in there. So I will be violating the rules. But So I would be very happy to discuss this, but then, you know, maybe at the end we'll discuss it. But we make some effort to understand what perturbation, what this mask do to the mitral cells, and what the duration of this mask. And what is important, that it's still localized in time, and animals does not make a right decision if mask is early, because some of the information is wiped out.
I think I missed, when you make the perturbation, what fraction of the receptors is
affected? We don't know. Some portion, we don't know.
Probably very small, right?
I mean, we try to do our best. We literally etch the fibers that it's not 4 pi, but at least, you know, broad area of illumination. But it's in the nose.
You don't know what fraction of receptors are activated during the actual behavior, right?
Yes, we don't know this. We don't know it.
You have to compare it with something.
Right. You don't know. So that's also is the perturbation specific to some receptor types, or is it sort of?
No, it's all OMP. This was general adoption in all receptors, so it's. Stimulating. It's just basically, I show you the picture and blast a lot of light to your retina.
So the bottom line was, what was the time scale beyond which it didn't matter? I mean, so up to some time scale it matters, right? I mean, so the idea was, if you perturbed initially, it did something. If you did late,
yeah, and that after 100 milliseconds, it almost doesn't matter.
After 100 milliseconds.
Yeah.
So if you shine light to a small area in the body,
we're trying to do it now. Basically, if our model is true. So then perturbation, even a single, very few spots on the beginning should be enough to ruin the behavior. However, there's a problem. So we try to do it, and we have very initial results. The problem with every model, you know, we can kind of save the model or something like this. So basically what's going on, maybe when you're presenting an odor and you're blasting a lot of light, it's actually a mask. But if you're perturbing one glomerulus and it's kind of not really associated with this odor, animal may very easily just kind of consider it's complete distractor and not paying attention to it. I don't know, and that's a subject of exploration. We're playing with this. All this experiment takes a lot of time, because you need to get to stable behavior, you need to kind of really control behavior and then start doing perturbation. Perturbation you can do very often, because then there's other consequences. So it's not easy way.
When you shift to negative times?
We're considering to do it in negative time, but the problem with doing negative time is that if you don't know the duration of the mask, what will it tell you? So you need to know effect of the mask, because you start shifting, and sooner or later, if you shift here, it for sure will the behavior will recover. Mm-hmm. But when you start, most interesting part where it's kind of going back. But we only recently developed the methods of finding the effect, how long the effect of the duration of the mask is. Now we're considering doing these experiments.
Also, negative masking, you have to kind of do somewhat randomly and then post hoc choose, right?
Yeah, but this is technicalities, right? Right.
I guess what you were just saying, that these sort of points, just a few glomeruli activation during the early times, I think that's even more interesting experiment, right? Because this, with the white field isolation, I would say, well, it's really perturbing. They might not even be able to do that discrimination, but if you can even show that only a few spots.
No, but that's exactly the point. It's not negative, it's positive. I perturb a lot, you know, I would be, you know, it's a big hammer, but this hammer works here.
No, that's all.
Yeah.
So this experiment identifies that this sort of perturbation has an effect early and not late.
Exactly.
And then now there's a question of how widespread this perturbation has to be. As in, how many glomeruli
that
has to affect in order to have...
That's a second, this is a second question, then that's the subject of current studies in the lab, basically. Yeah. Yes?
So you're saying here that at 20 milliseconds from inhalation, you have a very strong effect. At 120, there is very little effect on the behavior. So these are like 100 milliseconds of delay, presumably between the first glomeruli that get activated and the last glomeruli. But how well do we know those activations? Because the data usually come from either intrinsic or synaptic flooring or calcium imaging, and all those things are really slow. So actually, do we know what the...
Let's talk about this later, okay? It's all important questions, but let's maybe talk about one. Because I'm going to talk now, so that was basically set up the scene, set up kind of the idea of the model, that the first few glomerulus matters. And now we actually would like to understand what's going on in mitral cells. Yes?
I'm not sure how analogous this is, but in other sensory modalities where you can deliver what seems like a constant stimulus, mm-hmm. which is hard to do here because he's sniffing, mm-hmm. it's almost always the case that the efficiency of integration goes down dramatically with time. So, mm-hmm. for instance, if you try to detect a tone in a noisy background,
yep.
then your threshold goes down as 1/√ of time as you lengthen things, suggesting that you're doing very efficient integration, right? So that you basically integrate the power of the signal, right? Mm-hmm. But that bends over somewhere 100, 150, 200 milliseconds, depends on details. So I think that in almost every case where, and the same is true for detecting, for intensity discrimination, vision, things like that. Right? So there are situations in which you can force people to integrate for a long time, but they don't do it very efficiently if the stimulus is constant. So maybe what you're seeing is, so what I don't know is if in those situations, if you put in a, and of course there's a tradition of doing kind of masking experiments with physical stimuli. And I don't know whether that resets the integration, right? So if in fact the system is set up so that it integrates, paying very, very efficiently at the beginning and then kind of tails off, like every other system, and the mask doesn't reset this process, then you would expect to see what you see, even if it were the auditory system. And nothing to do with sniffing, nothing to do with,
I don't think it has anything to do with sniffing. I don't think this is just, it's the first wave of information. What it has to do with this graph, that if you look on the activity of the glomeruli, they started, building up this, image from, let's say, 30 milliseconds at the beginning and ends up at the end of the sniff, and sometimes longer even. Some glomeruli respond after the second sniff. What I'm trying to say, that this portion is already after. So we don't, kind of, this part is irrelevant for this behavior.
But I think maybe you should remind Bill, if he doesn't know that, you and Anders, you've already shown that it's really, behaviorally, it's only 100 milliseconds or so that's relevant anyway, right?
Well, I take it cautiously, because it depends on the strength of the,
in this particular task,
right.
That's the point. Exactly the size of your example, right?
Right.
They have shown repeatedly
right.
that it's enough, the first 100
milliseconds. No, but the problem here, just a second, guys, the problem here is kind of much more fundamental, because people spend a lot of time trying to understand these patterns. And these patterns, if you look at the imaging data, you look at this pattern, and you consider all glomeruli equal. And people study how the order maps on the bulb. What we're actually saying is, forget all this. Look at the map of the first few. That's very important. And that's where the information about order identity is carried. This is not important for most of the task. Maybe for some of the important, so I need to be careful. That's the point. I'm not talking about the mechanism of the mask. I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about the code here. Relevant for behavior. Yes.
So this question, I guess, related to the comment that he made. It may be that they're only attending to the first 100 milliseconds, basically because of the task, because of the behavior that's supposed to, mm-hmm. that they could be trained mm-hmm. to attend to things later. In which case, this is really something that you're learning about the task, not the coding strategy.
Absolutely, and that's just the beginning. We try to do this the first task when we pose it the problem like that. We kind of, but I agree. If you make the task probably harder, it may attend not to first P, but not five, but seven glomerulus. I don't know. This is hard. It's difficult to actually figure out what P is. And the second thing is that it's very important now. So you can train an animal to pay attention to glomerular L. And we did it with single glomerular stimulation in the presence of the odor, and they can detect late in the sniff cycle stimulation of the single glomerulus.
You mean pay attention to this glomerulus no matter what else is there?
Like yes, so we make an experiment when we present odor A and odor A plus excitation of one glomerula late in the sniff cycle. No problem, animal can learn the task. My kind of take on it, that the first few glomeruli is your normal performance. That's how you learn to do the task. It's your fovea. It's your kind of, you foveate in order to identify the object. But you can train an animal to use peripheral vision.
What I said is almost the reverse. First you want a coarse thing, and then if you need to waste time,
Exactly. So first you pay attention to the first few glomeruli. That's your kind of main mode of perception. And that's what animal trained to do when it's asked to discriminate A versus B. But if you push the animal, they can learn to discriminate other stuff. So this information is available to perception, but it's not normal mode of operation.
When do they usually lay in this task?
We have the data. They come to, so the midpoint performance, so it's some speed accuracy trade-off. It's about 150 they reach a midpoint. At 200 they at maximum performance.
You're not making millisecond. This is go as soon as you can. Right?
Say it again?
It's go as soon as you can. You're not making them.
No, we don't make them wait, but it is some caveat with measuring reaction time because initially I don't know if I need to go. There's a grace period at the beginning that we're shutting down, so this is kind of, it's not always easy to interpret the reaction time. But currently the data looks, so it is something like this, and this point is 150 milliseconds, this is about 200 milliseconds. The leaking time for the this is performance.
So often the mask comes before the actual.
Oh, absolutely. So that effect is before the leak.
So yeah. Can you imagine a series of tasks where you train the mouse to pay only attention to the first glomerulus that lights up, then to the first two, then to the first three, then to the first four?
Yes.
You can do that?
No, I can imagine.
I should phrase my question more carefully. All right. You're imaginative. Can you do it?
Exactly. Okay.
But I'm a little confused because you start with this consistent odor quality across, right, intensity. Yet you say it's not so important for mammals, mouse can learn, right? And they must be, you know, having different odor quality, no? Mm-hmm.
May or may not. I don't know how to assess it. No, because basically I know that animal doing decision A versus B, this is odor quality independent of concentration, odor identity, you name it, I don't know how. Something that is independent of concentration. So that's what animal making decision. And what is the use of this glomerulus? Maybe, you know, it's for perception it's a hard problem because if you start to train to the concentration, for example, they can make a decision by the concentration, by the other cues when the first glomerulus shows up. So on the concentration task, there's other. So you don't know how mouse is making decision on the specific task versus what is a perceptual variable. That's a hard problem for the animal, you know.
But
we actually have some approaches how to judge intensity, but that's way beyond this talk. And I actually strongly promote the paper that has been published last year by Evgeny Sirotny. He made a very beautiful work how you can actually judge the perceptual intensity of the odors and in pure behavioral experiment.
I'm just kind of getting confused about the concentration thing. Isn't the first spike latency about its concentration dependent so that the first
Yes. And that's why we see the temporal shift in the mask. That's exactly. Your high concentration information coming early. Exactly. Okay.
Just one curious. So if you had the mask on and trained any of these simulations in A and B, but you have the mask on all the time or in the regime where...
We tried at the very beginning and the performance started improving. And if you keep the mask long time, it probably will learn other cues. But mouse will, you know, will learn to discriminate two empty vials if you train them long enough. Okay. I'm actually serious. I know it for a fact. It's not, no, just. So it's just a matter of time. They
How?
Magic.
Well, one is what you think is empty vial.
Yeah, exactly. So very minimal cues by just some residue that you left by your
CBT.
Where they kind of, you know, it's very hard to do, you know, for example, the text that they showed, you leave something in the vial, you touch the vial with your fingers, that's enough. That's enough, they will start cheating on that. Okay, guys, let me move to the second part, kind of.
I mean the second slide.
Right. But hey, I very much, you know, that's fun. So what we want to understand, actually, so if we know this idea, so let's kind of start thinking about it, what mitral cells are doing. And we want to record from mitral cells in general order presentation. I wouldn't be talking about mask response of mitral cells, but I would like to understand what actually mitral cells doing and how this is consistent with our ideas. So let's leave for a while the old primacy ideas and come back to them later. But let's just start kind of thorough to some on some level analysis of mitral cells activity and what conclusion we can say just measuring the activity of mitral cells in this mode to multiple orders. So we present orders and measuring mitral cells activity as multi-electrode system. This is our behavioral setup. So before we're putting mouse into the setup, we very thoroughly measure the order delivery. So we measure with photoionization detector the reproducibility of these slopes, 1-2 millisecond, and approximately in 40 millisecond, the odor becomes steady, and that's when mouse start inhaling. So we do control stimulus to the best of our ability, and this is a noise measured by PID. At least the noise in the odor is not larger than that. So we do invest a lot of effort. By the way, if you adjust minor technical point for efficient another, if you don't tune this, if you just assemble such olfactometer and start presenting orders, you can get all kind of crazy stuff here with the peaks, with the slow decay. So if you don't have PAD and try to do something with timing, I would believe you. So
also, you know that, you know, theory minus work with different orders.
Exactly, right.
Have you seen this for all the ones?
So the timing is actually depends on the order. So we try to, yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a big hassle. We spend a lot of time doing this. So if we want to do some timing, you know, aspect, it's important. For example, just. You mistune some of the order delivery, and you see that order delivered PID trace like this. Something like this. Or vice versa. It's kind of make a blip, then like this. So just, yeah, and that has nothing to do with, you know, it's just pure order delivery. So be guys very careful when you, and it can last, you know, for a second.
So Dima, I have a devil's advocate question about these timing things. So it's clearly very hard to control. So why would this be in any way important for actual natural olfaction?
No, it's important for experiments. It's not important for natural olfaction because we want to know what we're measuring. That's, you know, animal doing decision based on, you know, many other stuff, other cues, but at least we need to know what we're recording.
I mean, and natural stimuli have high-frequency temporal structure, right, that might or might not
do
be very, very important.
The nose is the low-pass filter anyway.
I don't think so. So there's a lot of information in the temporal fluctuations that tells you about distance, directions, and so on. So if you want to understand how this temporal structure might be processed, you first need to be able to...
Absolutely.
This is a very controlled, relatively artificial stimulus because it's very square.
Yeah, but at least we know they're unsated. So our take on it is that actually the major dynamics of the stimulus is if we control stimulus correctly, if we do square pulse stimulus, the main dynamic is defined by the sniff cycle. So when we put the mouse, first thing we do, we implant the pressure cuddle and record the sniff. Oops, sorry. And record the sniff. It's kind of delayed. You know, I press the button and it's... Yes, exactly. Okay, I need to train myself not to respond quickly. So basically, this is a sniff cycle recorded. But this is a pressure signal. Again, if you put a pressure, sorry for this technical issue. If you put a pressure signal, you may get a very arbitrary delay between the airflow and the pressure signal if you don't calibrate the signal. You do need to calibrate your pressure sensor against some calibrated air source, because just the length of the tubing and the volume of the pressure signal can give you 20 millisecond time difference. We learn it hard time, so be aware. So when we time this signal to this to the stimulus, just there's a lot of caveats there. But this is a pressure signal. Exhalation is down, inhalation is up, and this is slow sniff cycle. This is fast sniff cycle. And for the sake of this argument, I don't discriminate between breathing and sniffing. What I care about that sniff is actually that mouse is inhaling. Is it active or passive? It's not an issue now. That's the dynamic of the stimulus is fully defined by the airflow that we measure through pressure signal. Happy mouse in front of the odor port with the sniffing cannula, with olfactometer sniffing cannula, and a bunch of devices. Usually we started with a single unit, but we switched to silicon probes. Okay, long old story, but nevertheless, we measured the response of the mitral cell, many trials in response to odor, almost no effect, but the mouse is sniffing. When we synchronize it with the onset of inhalation, boom, the response appears. And I'll be talking a lot about this kind of response. And so basically now, what's important feature? The number of spikes in this response and the latency, also the precision, variability, all other stuff. So I would not talk much about the number of spikes. I would talk about the latency of the response. So most of my discussion today will be about the latency. And I also skipped the point about we published the paper about the precision and how precise the signals are. So please, or we can discuss it later. The bottom line, it's approximately 10 millisecond precision. It's comparable to what LGN tells to the cortex in a visual, in a natural scene analysis. Not retina, but LGN. But mitral cells are the cells that send a signal to the cortex with approximately 10 millisecond temporal precision. So it's kind of almost like vision. That's the precision. I wouldn't talk about the precision now. So what is responsible for the latency? And here's our thought about it. So mouse is inhaling an odor, and you ask a question. We believe that odor concentration raises gradually in the nose and kind of follow the sniff cycle. Our belief is based on on some simulation. I talked a lot with Kai Zhao from Monell, who doing a model simulation. I would be very interested if somebody theorists want to model it in a simple way, not running through whole fluid dynamics, but kind of making a physical model of the nose. Be very, very interesting to talk about it, because it's fluid dynamics, it's diffusion through the mucus. It's a lot of factors, but I think it can be some simplification done here. But this is a cartoon. When concentration raises some level, the mitral cells fire, and mitral cells connected to OSNs. OSN fire and then leads to firing of mitral cells. And so basically, this axis, the more sensitive fire first, the less sensitive fire later, and this axis is affinity. And so this, the stronger order is affinity to this receptor. It will fire earlier, and weaker will fire later. And that we'll talk a lot about it in a few slides.
So for, to clarify, you talk about mantle cells, but these are mantle untargeted cells, right? Are you talking specifically?
No, mantle untargeted cells. I cannot differentiate it with my electrodes. I don't know what they are.
But it's very possible that actually you're only talking about tufted cells here, mantle cells.
I doubt. I think that just by the depth of the recording, it's all over the place. Well, so the.
Why would you think that it was just tufted cells? Could it be quicker?
At least from precise experiments. And also from his experiments, they fire much more quickly than mantle cells.
But that's, I mean, I don't think that that's, I have the data, I'm not sure that I have the data in this, so mantle cells can fire also fast. So, okay, the first interesting feature is that actually the inhalation varies in time, in duration. So if mouse inhaling slower, the concentration in the nose will rise slower. That will lead to some temporal shift of the spiking activity. So timing of the spikes will be the function of the inhalation duration. That leads to the idea that actually the spikes are locked not to the absolute timing but to the phase of the sniff cycle. And if you look carefully in this graph, so what we did in this work, we actually measured the inhalation and the duration of a whole sniff. So you can see this stuff. And if this is true, then warping the stretching and compressing the sniff duration to the medium one will make this peak even higher. And that's exactly what's happening. Basically, when we make all inhalation and duration the same, we make the peak heights cell become much more precise and fire in much more in much higher temporal precision. This work need to be more work done, kind of to find directly the relationship between inhalation and time spiking. The problem with that we can't accumulate enough trials for a given inhalation duration. So this is a trick around that. Because in general, you need to accumulate many trials with medium inhalation duration, short and long, and see how it scales down. And this is not under our control. This is under mouse control. But overall, this behavior, I believe this also depends slightly on others.
So it seems like, I know this is a bit of a reading tea leaves, but the off response also is very precise now, which, you could take some evidence that the order is still hanging around.
Yes, and locked to the EAS. So it's not only, so what's surprising in this work that I kind of can explain or can hand wave it here, but I don't know what makes the precision on the second part of the sniff. So this simple model would work at the end of the sniff. However, we do see the same effect on the second half of the sniff.
So, quick question.
Yes.
So this is one particular mantle cell that you showed.
Yes, this one. So but we saw it in many cells.
I'm totally sure of that. My question is, are the latencies different for different glomeruli? That's what you're going to show next?
Yes.
They are different
for glomeruli.
And is that, does that have something to do with the ligands that bind to the receptors? Or
can you postpone this question for later? Okay. Now, the same thing happens with the concentration. If you increase concentration, the rise of this curve is steeper. The cells fire earlier, and spike timing is a function of concentration. So basically, spike timing is a function of affinity, concentration, and sniff features. So how to make sense of it? And before we that we measured in with Evgeny Sirotin and Roma. We measure that if the response of the mantle cells is, what I'll do, I'll move it here so we can, I don't need to close. Yeah. So the response of mantle cells is shown here. If you increase concentration, it shifts forward. So, but I will again come a little bit more about the timing.
Maybe this is too much of a detail, but if you can achieve this level of precision, you might wonder whether variability of the SNP
yes.
is correlated with the variability of the output. So on every trial, the SNP's not exactly the same.
Right.
The time course of the odor is not exactly the same.
Yes, it can be worked out, but I don't.
I was just saying, you just really, I think in some sense, you want to do 100 microcells at once, you don't have to worry about warping or not.
100 cells at once?
You can imagine, right? So you don't have to do the warping, you just do the other time.
Mm. And the reason you're doing the aligning is warping is because you know, before
Exactly. We do warping basically to understand the feature of the signal.
There will also, even if you have the same exact SNP waveform, there will be variability just because of...
Right, but you want to kind of get rid of the variability to do the sniffing, because you have variability due to neural mechanism, you do some, but you have some variability due to the sniffing, and that warping allows us to at least get rid of some variability.
But I mean, for Bill's comment, isn't your point actually somewhat the opposite, that although you have maybe different SNP lengths actually across the population of cells, your prediction would be that it's independent whether the SNP is a bit longer or a bit shorter, the relative timing between the different...
Not relative timing, relative phase.
That's
what you're going to use for your privacy coding anyway, right? The relative phase and the difficult variable.
Probably, because on each sniff, I don't know what, you know, in each sniff, it's also timing. So the phase is the way of analyzing the data. I don't know how much this plays a role. So it's relatively simple to understand how this code can be read in the cortex. And if at this time window the cell 2 and 5 fires, they stimulate some cells in the cortex. And if you change, they simulate the sequence 1, 2, 3 in the cortex. If mouse inhaling slower, they stimulate the same cells, but preserving the synchrony, so the same cell will be stimulated in the cortex. The same thing happens with the concentration. If you increase concentration, the same cells will be stimulated in the cortex. And it's kind of plausible model for the readout or the questions to, but that works only at the beginning of the SNP cycle. Because if you stimulate further down, they start interacting and that's becoming a mess. So at the beginning, we have some consistency. We don't know what's going on later. And about readout, all the question to Kevin.
But really, you're preserving the order, not the timing, right?
I'm preserving the order, exactly.
So I think the integration has to be balanced there. At some point, it's not just the order.
Right. I'm kind of slowly coming to the most interesting part, but briefly going on through the previous work, we call it many cells, many orders. This response of one cell to many orders. You see the diversity. For two orders, they respond very sharply and briefly. One order, long, prolonged, excited response. For another, inhibited response. And this cells by itself was locked to the sniffing cycle, so we're talking about the deviation from the spontaneous rate. Here we have many cells, one order, also multiple signature of the responses. And if you get everything together, out of 460 cell order pairs, 136 was initially excitatory, meaning the deviation from the spontaneous rate was positive. And we put all the cells in one graph, and we order them in the sequence or in the order of the peak, and we get this picture. So if you believe that our sampling of mitral cells and our order presentation is random, then on one order, that's what the cortex will see in average. So we can kind of replace 460 cell order pairs that we measured, and one third was responsive to total number of mitral tufted cells, third was excitatory. So that's what the cortex is. That's what we're trying to understand, because on one sniff, cortex is bombarded by these signals. Third of the cells sending something to the cortex at different time window. And of course, cortex doesn't see it instantaneously. It first sees this 10 milliseconds, and then this 10 milliseconds, and then later 10 milliseconds. So what is going on? What's basically, so how it can be read, it's concentration, beginning is concentration variant, later we don't know. It's sniff maybe invariant, but what the cell's telling the cortex. And my previous experiment tells you, just a second, let me finish, that this part is important. This part is important, the rest, we don't know. Just, I'm not saying that it's not important. It's not important for this task, but for what it is important, we don't know. Yes?
Could you also comment, just like from this pink bar, what the time scale is by which the inhibitory activity, the bulb will kick in, and then at what time scale, the feedback activity, cortex, will affect the bulb? Can that appear on this graph also?
No, I have the data. It's slightly late. So basically, when we did exactly the same graph, for the inhibitory cells, they started just slightly below, so the first cells evoke the inhibition. So we sample some subpopulation of cells. We don't know, but you see some of the activity, you see some of this.
So broadly, this is consistent with the idea that many speakers mentioned, that the initial phase of the response is a reflecting order identity, and that later phase of the response could start reflecting more like the meaning and valence of the order and stuff like that.
I don't understand what that means, actually. I don't understand what that means, that that part reflects valence. I don't understand what that means, because, of course, if you read all this information, you know the valence. But what that means, that that's reflect valence, I don't know.
Yes, contracts, right? The same order, the
fact that we have correlated a response context and the later response, or valence and the later response, it doesn't mean that it reflects valence. Sorry, guys. That's my take on it. You know, we can find this correlation for sure. You know, this is a lot of cells. You know, it can, you know, 15,000 cells with 10 bin precision, you can, you know, it can be much more than trillion others with all valences, with everything. I'm not sure that that information is.
They're just very good intermediate coupling. I mean, the first inhibitory responses you see that are coming from some interneurons in the bulb are also within that pink window, right?
Yes.
And if you do a slice experiment to simulate one nitro cell and look at some you'll see inhibitory responses within a few tens of milliseconds at least. So I think, I mean, except for the very first wave of activity, the next spikes from nitro and tuft cells can be contaminated by the 95% of neurons that we're ignoring if you talk about the bridge.
Isn't a few tens of milliseconds very quick, so the synaptic, disynaptic?
No, but there's feed forward.
Yeah, it's also feed forward inhibition.
Might even get inhibition generally before they get excitation.
Sure.
And even the disynaptic inhibition between nitro cells, you see that the rising of that inhibition happens relatively quickly because it's happened to a large extent happens within the dendrite. Right. So I think it's.
Yeah, just trying to sort out the timescale.
Yeah, sure. No, that's important. Joe.
So in humans, we take a pretty ballistic sniff. So right, no matter what you're smelling for the first sort of 150 milliseconds, all the sniffs, if you line them up, they all look the same. And then we modulate based on concentration, right? So we take a smaller sniff for high concentration odors. Mm-hmm. Do you see that in mice? Do they have a precise ballistic sniff? How fast do they modulate concentration, relative concentration?
Yes, so the right person to ask is Matt Vachovic. They can modulate the sniffing very, very fast. This strongly increased the sniffing rate for the novel order, and that would actually.
No,
within a single sniff.
Sorry. In a single sniff, I thought it from sniff to sniff.
Right, so in humans, we sort of predict that basically they are sensing concentration fast enough to modulate their sniff at that point, right? You can tell if the person is sniffing a high concentration or low concentration odor by about 150, 200 milliseconds.
I don't know any data that animal can modulate the sniff on the duration of the sniff inside one sniff.
Well, there's this Moss paper, right?
No, this is a second sniff. Basically, the second sniff can come earlier. That has been measured. But the fact that you do it slowly and then do it even longer or slow.
Or strong one and find it's horrible when you sniff. Right. I think one within
120 milliseconds, there is already. They found that the second sniff can come, the normal sniffing pattern is about, you know, 300-400 milliseconds. If they inhale a new order, the second sniff comes about 140 milliseconds.
So maybe a more practical way of answering this question is to look at the shape of the respiration curve, right? You see a fair amount of variability from sniff to sniff. But is the initial inundation part of each sniff fairly similar?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that also puts a time limit on your you must calculate concentration. If you can look at the sniff and tell after 150 milliseconds if they're sniffing a high or low concentration, that's the timing at which the computation must have occurred.
I never look inside the one sniff, and I doubt that Matt Vachovic also looked. What known is the mouse is sniffing much faster, so
exactly. It's, so that's why it's not clear if it,
right.
The human maps to the
right.
Well, we've done that a little bit by looking at, because when we looked at sort of how activity might change during training,
yeah.
We've seen some cells that change their...
No, we're talking about...
Change their firing rate, or change their depolarization, etc. But in every single case, there was a change. When we looked and compared sniff waveforms, the sniff waveform, the previous inhalation, the first inhalation was already a bit faster, a bit slower. So we couldn't say that any of that activity might not simply be a consequence of changes in sniffing. So I think there's variability in sniffing. It's not clear whether that has been, even on the first inhalation, whether that is a modulated one that has consequence on order of activation.
But that's kind of summary of previous work. And here, what I would like to take seriously is actually this question. So what's with this affinity? What's actually... Because if you think about it, order can be defined by the vector of affinity to the receptors. If you know all repertoire of receptors, you know all the affinities. This is a unique definition of the orderand. So we want to take it kind of seriously. So what we need to do for that, if we want to do this, we need to take an order, measure activity of each individual glomerulus, know the affinity of each individual receptors, and then go and measure the timing and other features of the code on the mitral cells level. So far, this is, I don't know how to solve the problem, even for two glomeruli, just to comparison, but we know how to do this for one glomerulus. So we present an order, and that we can track the signal through one glomerulus. But instead of changing the glomerulus, we decide to change orderands, affinity. Basically, we change the problem from measuring for one order many, many receptor types and many mitral cells with unknown inputs. We do something different. We present an order for the glomerulus, and we track the activity of the mitral cell that is connected to the known glomerulus. And the rest of the talk will be about that. So, and we'll spend some time here. So, it has been done a little bit. So, it has been done by lab of Ninmin Lu and Minhong Ma. They did it in a synthesized animal. They patch the dendrites below the glomerulus, and basically their conclusion, and they measure the activity of the receptors in the in vitro preparation, and their conclusion was that basically mitral cells more or less do the same thing what glomerulus tell them to do.
This was also a misplaced exogenous glomerulus.
I don't think that that's, yes. I think that's not, I mean, it was misplaced, but it, at least the first measurement had been done by these guys.
What does it mean they just do what they, I don't understand.
So, okay. Andreas pointing out that what in this paper has been done, that they know the receptor identity, but this specific receptor has been the glomerulus located in the ventral side. So with genetic method, they moved the glomerulus with this receptor on the dorsal side, and this sprint was misplaced activity. I don't think that is the main caveat of this experiment.
It's not about that. This question is more about what you said before. Yeah. The mitral cell is listening to what the glomerulus is saying.
But it surely does, so I'm confused.
No, basically the receptive field of the mitral cells more or less same as glomerulus, at least at low concentration, high concentration became a little bit more narrow than glomerulus. That's the very basic
result. Isn't that a conventional picture that I would naively take away?
Say it again?
Isn't that a conventional picture that I would naively take away, that the mitral cell feeds forward and there's some inhibition,
yes,
some
yes.
Narrow inhibition?
Yes, 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 yes. We know that there's not one mitral cell, but multiple mitral cells, and do they tell the brain the same thing or different thing? That problem has been addressed by Dino, who we're really missing here. He was supposed to be here, but he'll be here next week. And he said that, you know, overall mitral cells are kind of firing rate are correlated, but timing may be very different in different mitral cells. This also goes to the Nathan Urban work and some Troy's work, that mitral cells connected to the same glomerulus are actually different. So we decided to take it, you know, seriously and see what's going on in the awake animal. And this is a hard problem, because how we will identify the position of the mitral cells, recording of mitral cells. So we make a mouse that has, we want to record the mitral cells connected to a specific glomerulus, and compare this activity with the property of the receptor neurons. And receptor we can quantify in the dish. We can present the order in the dish and take concentration series for a given odorant and see what signal this odorant evoke on the mitral cells. How to find mitral cells? So we have a mouse that have general adoption in one individual receptor type, M72, built by Tom Boza. We can shine the light on these glomerulus and find the mitral cells with a short latency of the response to light. And this is done in a awake animal. Basically, this is an awake animal. We can hook up, we can record the signal. See, this is a response to the light in a awake animal. Then we forget about this light, but we know the identity of the cell. And now we can record the response to odorants in a awake animal. The experiment looks like this. He has the mouse sitting in front of the odor port with a laser hooked up, positioned above the glomerulus. We put electrodes underneath. We're actually searching for that. We blast the light. We find the response. We stop searching. We fix the electrodes. We forget about the light, and we present different odorants. This is a response to two ligands, etylglate and 4-methoxyacetophenone. Both of them activate this glomerulus. And what's interesting that etylglate is a strong ligand. So the first prediction would be that latency of the response to etylglate, as I showed before, should be earlier than latency for methylacetophenone. And that's exactly what's going on. So we were very happy that affinity is actually, timing is the function of affinity. Yes?
How do you do this experiment in awake animals? Because in awake animals, you're going to get all these descending projections that is going to add confusion to the an inhibitory interneuron that is going to be targeted by feedback and so on. So why didn't you do it in deeply anesthetized animals?
Because of the role of inhibition that may be different in anesthetized animal. And so descending projection, we think that we're recording the same state. Basically, animal doesn't care about the orders. I agree, you better record in behaving animal. But I think the transition between awake and anesthetized is important. However, as Andreas taught us that we shouldn't care about that, so probably we should do it all anesthetized animal.
This is misquoting. Yes, yeah.
Right.
But how difficult is this? Do you think it would be easier to do it in anesthetized?
So, anecdotally, we see different threshold for light activity in awake anesthetized animal for the cells, not for behavior, for the cells. So something changes. The problem with that we want to do in awake animal, and I ask, my guys, okay, let's anesthetize animal at the end that kind of solve this problem. We're losing the cell. And so it would be basically statistical comparison, not a cell-by-cell comparison, awake and anesthetized.
It's a very difficult experiment to find those.
Yes, 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 yes. You need to search. So Nathan Urban make anatomical work and kind of try to find how many mitral cells connect to single glomerulus. It's about 10 mitral and 10 tufted. So we're searching in the whole mouse brain for 10 cells.
And these are with the four Shank-Wiedecki probes?
Sometimes two, sometimes four, right. So we record many other cells, and I will talk about it later.
How far are you going to work? 700 microns down?
No, usually some of them 300 to 500, usually. No, we're going, we can go straight because this is glomerulus, we're going on the angle and just trying to hit the area underneath. We're actually now doing the much more precise with single electrode. We try to map their position. Some of the cells are quite reproducible, but that's a work in progress.
We can take this.
Yeah, exactly. So what's the model here, basically? If you think that the receptor responses can be modeled by that, and you do need to reach some concentration to activate individual receptor that will, that will be enough to activate mitral cells. So the different level of concentration will be achieved at different ligands. So this is a different level. So you need to reach different level concentration for different tolerance to activate mitral cells. Now, if you see, if we believe in the previous model of the inhalation and the concentration depends on the nose, so we can project this there. So the timing of the activating of the receptor of the odorant A will be here, the most sensitive odor, the strongest odor for this receptor, odor B here and odor C here. Everything fine on the first approximation. Well, there's a problem here. There's a problem here that this curve is actually odor specific because the odor has different property, has different diffusivity. So the, in reality, this curve looks like it may be variable. Maybe faster or faster, slow. So this is, shouldn't be the strong predictor.
And if you have mixtures, you'll have competitive binding that will produce nonlinear.
It's too complicated already.
Okay, but still.
Right. So we're just trying to do some simple stuff. I don't know how. So with mixture, hold on a second. If you have competitive binding, I don't know how to deal with it. If you have a mixture, they definitely will have different affinities, and somebody will first, somebody will be later. So, so nevertheless, we were not scared of this problem. We decided to do it kind of systematically, and first we measured the activity profiles of many odors in Tom Bosa lab in the in vitro preparation. And this is the important curve. So this is the concentration dependence of different ligands. And we can order the sequence, the order. This is the receptor neurons, right. We can measure, we can order them by EC50. So at which concentration order activate this receptor. And the strongest is 2-hydroxytophenone. There are many ligands in the kind of intermediate and some weak ligands. All of these ligands activate my receptors. And for example, when I ask, Gino has the data. He said that etiutiglate is one of the best ligands for this glomerulus on the imaging studies. So this is our input data. What's about our output data? So we measure heroic effort of two postdoc and student in my lab. They did a lot of experiment, and here's the result. Cell one and cell two, and you can see this is the PSTHs. So I a little bit apologize. This is a data just fresh from the press. We get it. So we start working with the data only recently, so it's very fresh results.
This is mitral cells
connected to a specific to this glomerulus.
Same glomerulus.
All with the same glomerulus from multiple animals. So we go, we're searching for the cells, we're presenting a bunch of odors, and recording activity of the cells. So seven odors, and you can see, so this is green line is spontaneous firing rate. So some odors, for example, were inhibited. So what we did, we actually...
simultaneously
recorded some? No. We have very few simultaneously recorded. This is a miracle. It is. Yeah. No, one at a time. We record one cell at a time. We have two recordings over many, many recordings when we have two cells recorded together. That's to be analyzed. But I cannot make you know it's what this.
The variability between these two mitral cells is sufficiently, difference is sufficiently big, and this could be two different glomeruli almost.
No, this is the same glomerulus.
I know, but I'm just saying, they don't look anything like each other.
Exactly. So what we did, and this is partially, exactly. They are the same by the, so we shine the light, and we know that these cells connected has short response to later to light, and that's these cells we called not mitral but lateral cells.
Lateral cells.
This is a new term. So this is a lateral cell. So cell that responds to light and simulation of one glomerulus.
Do you have enough data yet to make glomerulus spontaneous?
They're variable. They're variable. No. That's actually low and high, and I admit completely that basically much more variability than we were searching without light. So you're right.
Partly.
Partly.
All
So we feed the data, and that's actually the work of the postdoc from Ira Simoncelli lab. He was working, he was building GLM model, tried to accommodate the variability of the SNF cycle. So this is the filters from the SNF independent filters. So it's kind of the signature of the cells with maximum, so trying to throw away maximum variability to the SNF duration.
So sorry, you know, the green is basically...
It's a baseline.
No, no, but you repeat it, you measure one baseline for all the...
So this is one cell, and this is the same baseline. This is another cell. You know, the green here is the same...
So are these in the same mouse?
No, this is different mice. But it's identifiable cells, you know, it's a... That's the point.
Wait, what's the green?
Green is spontaneous firing rate without air. Air responds to air.
The point is the point we are, but it's sniff locked.
It's sniff locked. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's everything
is
sniff locked.
Yes.
Right.
The
mitral cells sniff lock and they have spontaneous rate that is sniff lock. So that's a variability. That, you know, different odors excite different, and some of them actually inhibitory because the pulse is actually, it's, you see the spontaneous rate is earlier than the odor response. Here's actually a number of spikes smaller. We didn't yet do quantification, but this is a potential inhibitory response to the odor that drives these glomerulus.
So if I was to do some thresholding here, then would I conclude basically that the cell one going from glomerulus one, from the same glomerulus, basically responds to the 4-methyl WhatSIP and the 2-hydroxy, and the whereas the second cell is responding to ethyl tiglate and I don't know, some maybe completely.
So they're variable. Exactly. Basically the mitral cell responses to odors is quite variable.
The firing rate.
Firing rate and timing.
Timing also.
So timing of the peak. If you look at timing of the peak, they some of them earlier, some of them late. I have the data, and sure I didn't have the data here, but we have cell, and this is in response to mitral and tufted cells question that I should have prepared. So this cell responds to one order here and to another order late in the SNF cycle. Okay? These cells. Now, when you present a different order, they both respond here. The same cell to different order responds simultaneously. So if using Andreas and Izumi method, we will call this is a mitral and this is a tufted, they became both tufted for this order.
We talked about that separation from baseline firing, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure. We need to analyze all this stuff. We need to analyze all this stuff, but that basically, that's why I kind of, I think we see some of the mitral cells because some of them fire late enough. I will.
Try sorting phase of spontaneous firing. Do you get
not
some
yet.
Of the variability?
This is just discussion. Yes.
So going back to the early part of the talk, I think I'm not following here. It's again the timescales. As in, are these differences occurring in the early phase where you said order identity got coded, or are they occurring later on? Lots of these things are. 200 milliseconds, 300 milliseconds.
Exactly, exactly. So that's all over the place. Let me show you some data. So this is response of many cells to two orders, menthol and 2-hydroxyacetophenone. Again, if you look at this all the fits, so to menthol, it is responding all over the place and. This is some inhibitory and some and excitatory. Oh, you see the difference in excitatory responses. But 2-hydroxyacetophenone is like clock. So this response here. So something is special about 2-hydroxyacetophenone. So we have a lot of variability to the weak ligand and very low variability to the strong ligand. Yes?
So, do you have any idea where the variability is coming from? Is this coming from the inhibitory network?
It's one of the questions that I also ask you to postpone. I'll talk about it.
Sure.
You don't have a huge amount of time,
so... Oh, okay. Just everybody, no question, no more questions.
We're going to the negative time thing
now. Yeah, you don't want to cut it off, but I think...
Okay. So we decide to characterize the distribution of the latency for multiple cells, for lateral cells. And this is the distribution of the latency shown here for odor menthol. To what should we compare?
Don't let yourself get drunk. Keep going.
Yes. So, but what's we should compare with the whole ensemble of the other cells, because on the same electrode probe we record many other cells. We sort them, and distribution of the latency of the Menton response was like here. So this is the population distribution of the latencies. For different order, etiotic late, it's very similar. So the population response to the lateral cells is comparable to population latency, to distribution of latency to the whole population of cells that are not connected to the to these glomerulus. And for many others, it's actually the same picture, except two hydroxide cetaphenone. You see the big difference. It's the population response is very variable, but response to lateral cells are almost, you know, in the relatively low, relatively narrow distribution. And this is probably some,
no. Can you show the correlation with the firing rate?
No, not but yet. We're working. Right? Huh?
That's the expectation. The ones that are responding strongly should have very tight latency, right?
The one that
responds
most strongly.
Or is it not missing anything that's
a couple? I don't think so, because if you look here, the peaks of some of the responses for different orders can be high. So I'm not sure. We didn't analyze it precisely, but anecdotally, it's not. It may be some weak correlation. Yeah.
Does any of this variability correspond to the variability in the light-activated onsets?
We need to look at it. Light activated, the latency to light response is relatively low. So if this effect, you don't have much response. However, we, in order to be sure, we always blast a lot of light. So if we want to do it seriously, maybe the threshold or weak light activation may give us more dynamical range on this of the light property of the cells, and then we may correlate it with the other properties. But that's basically for light. We have a tag, this is lateral or not lateral, and we forget about light for now.
Do you think this is the optimal ligand for this receptor?
No, that's not important, whether that's an optimal receptor for the ligand.
So, no, this is...
I mean, the reason I'm asking is, it's much more precise than the others, but it's
yes.
Still around or just after 100 milliseconds, and for me, that's the experiment.
No, it's below 100 milliseconds, and I need to check the absolute timing, because it was, it's a timing to the peak and by GLM model, so let's come back to the timing later, absolute timing later. And
yeah, I mean, there's correlation between the onset of activity and the peak.
So we need kind of, currently the analysis was extremely simple. Guys, we're now analyzing this data, but I'm very excited about this data, so I decided to talk about it and see the feedback on that. So basically, 2-hydroxycetaphenone is special, and it actually stands away. We found it by mistake, actually,
it's fine guesswork.
It was a guesswork, and actually, we didn't have this curve. And we have all this order, and so we put 2-hydroxycetaphenone, saw this picture, I called to Tom, he measured it, and he said, wow, it's two orders of magnitude lower concentration. So that was very interesting observation, because it was not in the initial data set. So it's something special. So how can we explain this variability? Very simple cartoon model. Concentration raises in the nose as usual, and first it activates yellow, green, and blue glomerulus. That leads to activation yellow, green, and blue mitral cells. Now, when signals come to yellow glomerulus, it activates mitral cells, and all these cells are connected to the inhibitory network, and I apologize in advance. It's just generic inhibition between the layers. It's not granular cells that may be on the level of glomerulus, just we have cross-inhibition between different channels, between three channels. So. Now, what we see here, if the signals come to yellow, it drives mitral cells, and they receive mostly excitatory input, and they respond mostly kind of systematic because they have only excitatory input. As the time progresses, the green is excited by the green glomerulus, but they also inhibited by the previous glomerulus. And the same thing with the with the blue. So as deeper the sniff cycle you go, you evoke more and more inhibition, and inhibitory network is diverse. So because the cells from connected to yellow glomerulus have received only excitatory input, their diversity is based on their connectivity to this glomerulus. They're not subject of the inhibitory network. The rest diversity is a subject of inhibitory network that we kind of can be very, very different. And that's exactly what we see, because we see now we do experiment in a different way. We assume, and that's a strong assumption, that for 2-hydroxyacetophenone, we're measuring from the yellow glomerulus. And for menthon, we're measuring from the blue glomerulus. But we actually don't know. What is very hard, and I'm asking our receptor friends, you know, can you identify all strongest receptors for 2-hydroxyacetophenone? If M72 is actually the strongest, I believe it's not, but it's among the primary. So what we think that, now coming back to the primacy coding, we think that if glomerulus primary, its signature on the mitral cell level is different. And the mitral cells kind of synchronized in response to primary glomerulus versus non-primary. So the beginning of the sniff cycle, at the very beginning, when you have the first initial wave of activity, you have synchronization not only between two glomerulus that are kind of have similar sensitivity, but among the mitral cells that are connected to the same glomerulus, and that ruined as you go back to the sniffing cycle, and they desynchronize. So basically, inhibition is kind of temporal contrast enhancement. It basically desynchronizes the rest of the sniff cycle and keep and the absence of inhibition and just driving by the sensory signals keep the activity of the initial mitral cells synchronized. That's our idea.
So this, even sister, but just to repeat the point, even sister mitral cells, as you saw the dean of that, they can actually have different phases. They're not getting activated by the best ligand.
Exactly. That's exactly. So if you're not activated sister mitral cells by the best ligand, they desynchronize. If you shoot it with the strongest ligand, they all fire together.
So your experiments putting on gabazine and see what becomes
like. Well, that has been done by an anesthetized animal by 10, and you know they becoming much more similar, even though they didn't. Min and Lu. Technically speaking, yeah, we can do it, but it's a difficult experiment, and maybe this is, this is finding the cells, keeping them, and you know, it's a tricky part. But I would be very happy to discuss this.
If you do the functional imaging of the dorsal corcubus, the M72 glomerulus is the most sensitive.
I don't know how with functional imaging you find the most sensitive.
No, with two hydroxyl.
I don't know how to, because I talked to Matt Vachovic and he says that other glomerulus activated in this region. What I want to know, who is the first? And that's hard to do with the functional imaging.
Well, no, but if you titrate the concentration, you show that the both the,
So what are we talking about, concentration? Sorry.
You also use ligands that you know from in vitro experiments do not activate M72 and use the inhibition.
If we're in weak ligand, cause inhibition of these cells.
Yeah, but those that don't activate.
Huh? We see these effects. We see this inhibition. This is a ligand. This is a weak ligand, and we see the cells got inhibited.
The ligands that don't activate
M72? Honestly speaking, we didn't use non-ligands because we can kind of take any. Well, we should probably. Right, but
maybe mechanistically might be.
I think one of the thoughts what we have in mind is actually slightly shine the light and move the activation of the glomerulus forward, mm-hmm. and see if they synchronize or not. Something like this. Or do pharmacology. Pharmacology in a weak animal, I probably will call you guys.
You put in first muscle,
then I call you and we'll do it together. Okay, call you. So if this is model true, it should be concentration independent.
The first
Okay? This, the sequence of the glomerulus should be concentration dependent. And that, when we do this to hydroxyacetophenone, the distribution of the glomerulus, the distribution of the latency is going like this. So it shifts with the concentration. Menthon is a mess. Now, and the general population even doesn't change distribution. Now, we, this is just a cumulative kind of distribution of the latencies. What we did next, we kind of, we order them in the average latencies, and it becoming even worse mess, because you can see for 2-hydroxyacetophenone, the strongest concentration is first, medium is second, and the low is next. For menthon, it's even not true. We're jumping ahead. So we have the cases when increasing concentration move the spike back or evoking inhibition. It's a complete mess. How the general population also the complete mess, but 2-hydroxyacetophenone behave very, very systematically. What we don't know yet, and that's one of the questions, if it's the subject only of the ligand or is the subject of the timing. So do we really need to do this experiment, this hard experiment, or we can take any, you know, first active mitral cells and consider that it should work.
Does this mean that for an order to be perceived using, quickly perceived using your primate code, there should be a glomeruli that has this super fast activation? That is the glomeruli that... So how if
no, some glomeruli will be fast. Will be first, not
but
fast.
But I mean, how will you know that that glomeruli? So that glomeruli, that super fast glomeruli, that is like the MC22 and the acetophenone, should be like super fast. And if not super fast, there will be several glomeruli, and you won't be used, be able to use your primacy code, right?
Sorry, I'm not. I don't know what is super fast here. I'm talking about the first. At any sequence, somebody will be the first. Ah, for this experiment,
yeah.
Basically, in order to see the synchronization,
yeah.
I need to have strong ligand. For this ligand, M72 is among the first. That's the caveat.
For each ligand, there should one of the glomeruli, of the 1,000 glomeruli, should have this super fast.
First, not super fast. I don't like the word super fast. I don't know what super fast means.
Right.
It should be some glomeruli will be first, and that's the most important.
But more importantly is that all the mitral cells in the best
Right. They're very consistent. Exactly. That's the kind of finding.
So how many cells have you been able to actually get? The reason I'm asking is, but if you have more cells than you expect, different mitral and conducted cells, the question would be, do you see, even in the diverse response, do you see classes in those diverse responses? Or would that be a hint that inhibition is actually random between them?
We need to analyze it, and we need to coordinate with the SNF cycle and other stuff. I think we're recording for both mitral and tufted, but I cannot guarantee this. And how many we recorded? We recorded total about, you know, maybe 40 cells. But the point is that, for example, we cannot record in one experiment both many orders and many concentration.
Yeah. No, so, my question was, if you see the hyperpolarizing or inhibitory mental response, will every animal have a mitral cell at the M72, M71 neurons that is inhibitory for mental or not?
So you ask me to measure multiple cells on the same animal?
It's already shown in primary, these times are very animals.
Exactly.
But you know, isn't that at least 10 mitral cells there, some always gets inhibitory input from some possible region, some always gets inhibitory input from some lactic region. So
but
you might be seeing that if you just try to cluster those 40 cells.
That's it. Conclusion. Sister mitral cells have diverse responses to others. Receptive field of mitral cells not equal to receptive field of parent sensory neurons. However, mitral cells do follow a sense for strong ligand. And synchronization of mitral cells carry to the primary glomerulus. Mitral cell response systematically change with the concentration at the beginning of the SNF cycle, probably for the strong ligand primary glomerulus, but this is more general statement that needs to be discussed. And the conclusion from the previous talk, small temporal window at the beginning of the SNF cycle is relevant for behavior, and that leads us to the primacy coding model. This, all the stories, it doesn't tell you that the synchrony is used, but at least on the primary glomerular, we believe that there are mechanisms how this primacy can be read. That is already speculation. The important slide is, so many people participated in this work. Romer Schusterman, the first part of the work, now he is in Haifa. In current, my lab located at NYU, we moved there 2.5 years ago. Recording from single glomerulus was done by Ezekiel Arniada and Christina Penikis. Chris Wilson did behavioral experiments. The data analysis, we start collaborating with Ira's lab. Neil Rabinowitz is trying to feed GLM models and try to analyze all our data. This work can be done without Tom Boza. Jinji Zhang did recording of the patch of the sensory neurons. And of course, many, many discussions with Alex Kolokov. Thank you very much. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
So when you record from micro packet cells from MS52 or MS, and with weak ligands, you say that the response time is all over the place.
Yeah.
But some are actually some.
Yes, exactly. For some micro cells for even weak ligand respond early. Yeah. And that's probably because they don't get direct inhibition from the earliest glomerulus. That's the variability we're coming from. That's exactly. So if you come into this picture, so basically, so for if the odor doesn't excite yellow glomerulus, so some this micro cell would fire like this early, but that they get input from the yellow glomerulus will be maybe inhibited. That's the point. And we do see a lot of variability. You see? This is, for Fomenton, you see? And concentrations, again, all over the place. Some of the early concentrations even jump forward. Yep.
I have an outside the top question, but do we do it in vertebrates and invertebrates the fold is similar and do they sniff? I mean, they don't sniff.
So, A, flies don't sniff. B, the timing may or may not play a role because you can build the same argument by the strength of the activity. But I think what I actually was focusing, it's actually a very good point. I was focusing on the fluid dynamics idea that odors builds up in the epithelium slowly, concentration. But also the same effect on the intracellular integration. So strong ligand will evoke earlier spike. So maybe timing plays a role with the insect system. We don't know. The sister mitral cells, sister PN cells, have been measured by Rachel Wilson. They are very correlated. I need to look more in her paper. If this is the really strong odors, or maybe for weak odors, they will become decorrelated. I didn't look at this because this idea is quite fresh. We didn't look.
The origin of the correlation in the classical individual is that it's completely synaptic. It's single axon branching. So it shouldn't matter strong, weak, whatever.
So
the spontaneous synaptic events are incredibly correlated.
I see.
So
yeah, okay. Yeah.
If that's true.
Yeah, so there's probably a different mode of operation. We separated for some.
And of course, yes, worms evolution. Spikes,
Right.
So is inhibition random?
What does mean random?
Is there no structure to the inhibition?
The structure is in the receptors. So who activated the first the walk inhibition?
Yes, but basically any mitral cell can get any type of inhibitory input from anywhere. There's no structure to it. Basically, the first excitatory inputs come in. And then everything else is just blanket inhibition without any structure.
Or do you think that if you record from 72 nitrocells, you will find that systematically?
You want repeatable receptive fields, not if you now start taking into account inhibition.
Basically, so the question is, maybe it's due to learning, maybe, I don't know. Maybe, basically, is there, what you're asking, is the network of granule cells or PG cells are reproducible?
That's why
maybe
using non-ligands a little bit.
But you don't need
non-ligands.
Even if ligands has a lot of variability. I mean, what you're asking me to actually, to record nearby activity in this experiment.
No, if you see a response to a non-optimal ligand, can you predict
what
the response is to another non-optimal ligand in that cell based on what you see?
I don't have enough data. I don't think that I can now with this amount of data, but I would think that if I record activity of nearby glomeruli, I would be able to predict the.
But isn't this the like intrinsic, you know, signal using?
Say it again.
So recording from like random microcell, let's say, and then recording intracellular hypolization, and then from intrinsic signal imaging.
But except that was wrong, right? And this is Marcus, and there's Fontana and Meister pointed out that.
Yeah, but it's similar. So then there's some kind of structure, but may not tell you.
Yeah, I would be very, very, yeah, maybe to do some experiments like Marcus done.
Explicitly, we did that in a different way, and we found that it's not very easy. It's
exactly,
independent.
So
right.
They did our reproducibility, but it's there's no
Fontana. So they. Yes, so. But I don't remember what the data was from mouse to mouse. Do you remember?
No, nobody's looked at the reproducibility. I think that's what Kevin
did. Yeah.
You seem to have, like, you have X number of microcells from identified glomeruli,
right.
And to how many, 10 orders per cell? Something like
seven,
that.
Yeah.
So it seems like you have
to get maybe, yeah. Yep.
Is there any doubt that these cells are not from the
glomeruli? There's always doubt.
You're excited for your lateral responses.
Yeah. What I call lateral is a cell that gets direct input from the glomerulus. It's a functional definition. It's not pure anatomical. We know if we
but
don't
if
feel
the
cell.
Light, if you go down in light intensity, would that show you whether
you have variability. Some of them excited low intensity. Some of it need to be studied and
but
analyzed.
It's difficult to imagine that it's anything else but.
But what?
It's difficult to imagine that it's anything but the answer.
Yes. One. Yes. Yes. Yes.
What are the light responses, or what happens to light in the cell that you're not finding?
Some of them don't respond, some have inhibitory responses, over ability. We need, there's tons of data now, so if somebody is interested.
If I'm understanding this correctly, the way that this is happening is that methone optimally activates some other glomerulus.
Yes,
the,
exactly.
Here's, I know that the olfactory bulb has structure, but that's organized by how the chemical structure of the ligands, right? So if methone is fairly similar to acetophenone in that it can activate the same receptor, and yet you've moved this M72 glomerulus away from all the other glomeruli that normally respond to things that are very similar to acetophenone. Am I missing something? I don't know a lot about how the olfactory bulb is
this
organized.
This is a very interesting question coming back to.
It's similar to Andreas's early question. I'm trying to figure out how the inhibitory networks that are potentially optimized for like or nearby ligands.
Now we have tools to study this. Now we can move these glomerulus to some foreign environment and see if maybe so if the primase is local or not.
So you're thinking maybe the methone ones are still managing to affect from opposite ends?
Exactly. So here's a very interesting question. Do you need to have the faster glomerulus in the vicinity, or it's a global network? This is very interesting, important questions, but yeah.
Okay.
So.